Chapter 11, The Responsibility Remedy, 10 Ways You Can Compete, Prepare, Defend, and Get Ahead. Success on any major scale requires you to accept responsibility. In the final analysis, the one quality that all successful people have is the ability to take on responsibility. Michael Korda. Action springs not from thought, but from a readiness for responsibility. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. My aspirations for this book and indeed this chapter are quite humble. I did not set out to write a comprehensive policy manual on a topic as broad and far-reaching as responsibility. My highest hope is this book provokes a change in thinking and helps shift how we see what we want to change in our society. Many of the diverse and complex issues I have tackled do not allow for a simple or succinct solution. In addition, our crisis of responsibility has been building for at least a full generation and cannot be resolved simply by writing a book or preaching a sermon. Nevertheless, some practical suggestions would be helpful as to how you and me, the people on Main Street, can cure our addiction to blame before I pull it all together with a broader cultural takeaway in Chapter 12. I am an incrementalist. I believe problems created incrementally are most often solved incrementally as well. This tactical approach to life has theological foundations. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds come and perch in its branches. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into about 60 pounds of flour until it worked all through the dough. Matthew 13:31-33. Seeds take time to grow. Yeast takes time to work. I have every hope we will remedy the plight of those feeling disenfranchised in the global economy immediately. However, history teaches us that deep and meaningful cultural changes often take years, even decades, to take hold. Our culture did not inherit a crisis of responsibility overnight, but over a generational period of time beginning in the mid-1960s. It has marinated ever since in the seasonings of humanism, secular liberalism, and moral relativism. What we see in culture today is a reasonably consistent extension of the seeds planted then. The burden now is to evaluate what broad cultural endeavors are needed to resolve the responsibility crisis, Chapter 12. And in this chapter, identify what individual measures, steps, actions, and behaviors you can take to improve our cultural lot and advance the cause of human flourishing. In other words, what can you do? The list of 10 practical things you can do is intended to be bottom-up in nature, whereas the focus of the next chapter is more top-down in orientation. Many experts debate whether cultural transformation is catalyzed by top-down or bottom-up forces. Years ago, University of Virginia sociologist Dr. James Davison Hunter deeply affected my thinking on the subject. He suggested that top-down forces nearly always set off historical transformations. They did so not only via significant impact through large institutions, but also by leveraging the networks formed amongst various elites. As we'll see in the next chapter, Dr. Hunter is profoundly correct. The move to create culture-forming and culture-transforming networks to affect our society's top-down institutions is paramount. And yet, there simply can be no denial that big things can and do happen as a result of the faithful and seemingly minuscule endeavors of a few. In addition, we are concerned about society at large because we are concerned about people, individuals, families, and communities. While we seek societal transformation, we should pursue tools for the flourishing of individuals. So, should we focus on top-down or bottom-up solutions? The answer is emphatic yes to both. 10 Things You Can Do. The list that follows is not meant to be a financial planning checklist, though it makes sense to include a financial focus given my background as a wealth management professional. The focus is not merely on saving habits or investment returns, but also includes a variety of arenas in which one's thinking and commitments can either create heartache or substantially improve your ability to navigate through the present cultural challenges. The list is in no way intended to be comprehensive or convey a particular order or priority. Rather, it highlights the lowest hanging fruit, areas where action would surely move the needle in your life. Faithfully implementing best practices delivers two additional benefits. One, an example to others. Two, the fruit that faithful wisdom itself generates. Neither of these advantages should be discounted. To help resolve our cultural crisis of responsibility and pursue a life of freedom and virtue, I suggest the following. Number one, thoroughly repudiate defeatism and victimhood in your own life, even when you've actually been victimized. The second part of this admonition presents the greatest challenge, for most of us have been wronged at some point in life. But if we do not overcome our slights, they will overcome us. When our way of mindset centers on all the ways we've been wronged, the temptation to abdicate responsibility, even subconsciously, is simply too strong. The just toughen up crowd might appreciate this counsel, but would couch it as a call to grit your teeth and power through the injustices you've suffered. But there remains a better way. Repudiate defeatism because you crave an abundant life of joy, and repudiate defeatism by craving an abundant life of joy. Make that abundant life of joy both the means and the end. This approach requires a specific anthropological understanding, the awareness that you are created in the image of God with inerrant dignity. This awareness of basic spiritual and transcendent truths doesn't speak merely to your relationship with God and what He expects of you, though it does that too. Victimhood strips you of dignity and gives control and power to external forces, whether personal or impersonal. This surrender of control impedes the life of joy and strips you of the freedom you were made to enjoy. Your view of yourself cannot be one of me against the world. Believing that your boss, spouse, customers, or political leaders are all out to get you results in a life shaped by fear, not love, and certainly not joy. Might a spouse, boss, neighbor, or politician actually have it in for you? It's possible, I suppose. Yet even then, the productive response is not despair or defeatism, but courageous faithfulness. I've never seen someone who lives in a perpetual state of victimhood make good decisions. I've never seen defeatism result in anything but being defeated, or victimization create anything but a victim. A life of resilience will inevitably be a life of joy. As any joyful person knows, such resilience is fundamentally a matter of outlook and perspective. The decision to reject any suggestion that you are a victim of external circumstances is the sine qua non for those pursuing success in our complex modern life. Number two, completely rethink your perspective on higher education for yourself or your children. Critics might suggest a straw man interpretation of my point by saying I'm rejecting the merits of a college education, but that is patently false. What I'm suggesting is we acknowledge helpful truths. Is college a prerequisite for everyone? Of course not. Does college guarantee one an economically comfortable life? Of course not. Absent a college degree, will one be doomed to financial failure? Of course not. Is all student debt a good idea, regardless of the school, the subject matter, and the person's unique goals? Of course not. If we could fully grasp two truths, the scam that higher education has become would die. One, a college degree doesn't guarantee success, and two, not having a college degree doesn't guarantee failure. Inverting those two statements is what has fed the current college monster. So what are you to think? Am I suggesting college is a waste of time, a net negative for our society? Quite the contrary. As I detailed in Chapter 9, I'm highly critical of the business model and what is taught in today's system, but I passionately believe in the inherent value of a higher education, particularly in certain fields of study college ought to facilitate. I see incredible value to the college years of one's life being used to further solidify goals, interests, and passions. College ought to represent a unique opportunity to exercise responsibility, meet deadlines, and be intellectually and spiritually challenged. I'm not encouraging a universal rejection of college, but a realistic cost-benefits analysis of it, as opposed to making vanilla assumptions. One size fits all is generally a bad idea in any part of life, but when it costs $250,000, it can be financially fatal. The diversity of gifts, aspirations, goals, and circumstances invites a plethora of educational possibilities: trade school, apprenticeship, blue-collar work, entrepreneurial endeavors, and yes, college. I suspect that, even after a thorough analysis, most parents will still want their children to achieve a four-year undergraduate degree. I am simply suggesting you ingrain the two fundamental truths above before starting that journey. If you or your children do not go to college expecting a guaranteed outcome, you or they will be less likely to stumble into a crisis of responsibility when it doesn't deliver that outcome. The young adult years are pivotal parts of life. Parents and students alike should enter those years armed against disillusionment.